Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 29th of September 2013. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Rev Stan, Nick from Partially Obstructed View, and Phil from the West End Whingers. We're now going to talk about The Herd, which is on at the Bush Theatre in Shepherd's Bush. This is a new play by the actor Rory Kinnear. In fact, I believe it's his sort of playwriting debut. It concerns a family waiting for the young man, Andy. Andy is disabled. We're not entirely certain what the disability is, although something to do with Down syndrome is suggested. It's much worse than Down syndrome, is I think what we're told. So he is not expected to live much beyond his 21st birthday, much beyond his early 20s anyway. So there's a lot of tension like that. The first two characters we meet are the mother, played by Amanda Root, Carol, and she has taken charge very much of Andy's care. Although Andy is being looked after in a home, she is constantly on the watch, constantly on the wait for phone calls that might tell her to drop everything at a moment's notice to rush to his bedside. She has been like this, we discover, for a good number of years. She is visited before this birthday party by her daughter Claire, played by Louise Brearley, who has a secret that she's hiding from the mother, and is also bringing her, well, we're not sure if it's her boyfriend, she'd rather not say it is her boyfriend, but then he's played by Adrian Bauer. Also coming to this party are Kenneth Cranham, playing the Carol's father, and Anna Calder Marshall, playing her mother. And they are the grandparents of it. Anna Calder Marshall seems to have done an awful lot of work this year. I don't think she's been out of the theatre for more than a couple of weeks so far this year. It's very odd. Anyway, also coming is the divorced father of Andy, played by Adrian Rawlins, and he's coming into it to really upset everything. He's deserted the family because he couldn't cope, we're told, although it might be that Carol has just been a little bit too forceful in the way that she's sort of taken it all on herself, taken all the care on herself, and not trusting anybody else to do it, and being almost martyring herself in the name of caring for her sick son. I liked this play, but I could see the flaws in it. It's a bit argumentative and a bit shouty, but there were some very nice performances. I mean, certainly Amanda Root, I don't think I've ever seen her as good as this. I mean, she was absolutely on fire a lot of the time, and this is a really fierce performance by her, and I think it's because I associate her with slightly more gentle roles and rather nice people. She's a monster in many ways. She's really a fairly bad woman in some ways. I thought that's very powerful. I think we've all got good performances here, but it's certainly something that's a very good as a debut, and it's a well put together and well thought out play, and you do suspect, because if you know anything about Rory Kinnear's life, you know that there are certain aspects of this which are, well, slightly autobiographical, although I think he's been interviewed and said that he took a lot of care to take anything directly autobiographical out of the story when he wrote it. But it's a promising play. I don't think it's a fantastic play, but it's certainly a good one. What do you think about it, Rev Stan?
Well, I have similar views to you, really. I mean, as a family drama, I think the sort of the setup is very good. There was a lot that I could relate to, a lot of the issues in there I could definitely relate to. I thought where it worked best were in the lighter moments, the jokes, the sort of the funny scenes with the grandma and the grandfather. I thought Anna Calder Marshall was absolutely fantastic, and Kenneth Cranham as well, equally fantastic. I thought it was nicely observed, the sort of the hidden dynamics of the family unit, the sort of behind the scenes, the way families are together. There was something in there I think everybody could recognise from their own families, or at least degrees of it, and I thought that's where it worked the best. But when it just got, I just thought there was too much arguing, and after a while, when you've got characters that are sort of constantly sort of almost shouting at each other for long periods of time, it's like when you're on a bus and you hear a couple arguing, and it just gets really, really tedious after a while, and this was the same. And I think having that level of energy and argumentative conversation just got, I think there's nowhere you can go really from it. I think maybe they should have built up to some of these issues a little bit more gradually. Some of them just hit sixth gear straight away, and it just got a little bit, you just sort of thought, like, yeah, just move on, just you're getting a bit tedious now. So I enjoyed the lighter moments. I thought the more serious moments were just a bit overplayed, and maybe they need to have a look at how that's handled, because sometimes you kind of, while the nice elements of the family was nice to watch, you know, all families argue, and that is tedious. After a while, that's as tedious to watch as it is to sort of be a part of when you're in that family unit arguing. So, yes, it definitely had promise, and there was definitely some nice stuff in there, but it needs, I think, a little bit of work doing to it. A very good first effort from Murray Kinnear. And I look forward to sort of seeing what he does next, really.
Yeah, in all senses of the word, I think. he's depressingly talented, isn't he?
And he is, yes.
So, Nick, what did you think about The Herd?
I would agree with Rostan about the pitch of the drama, especially sort of the mid-section of the play. It felt to me as if Louise Brilli in particular, all she did for about half an hour was come on stage every so often, scream "Get out" at Adrian Rawlins, and then scream a bit more. And there is a bit of an issue there with the tone. I think elsewhere in the opening and the closing of it, I think the drama and the comedy are paced and kind of balanced a lot better. But certainly in that middle section, there is just this kind of thing you do occasionally see of drama translating into people shouting at each other for half an hour. So that, yeah, it's not a particularly satisfying part of the piece, and it is just a single tone that is very frustrating and just irritating quite quickly. But the rest of it, I think, is very impressive. I think he's if there's one thing that he's shown a talent for as a writer, Rory Kinnear, is in these comic one-liners or these little exchanges. And there's some really funny exchanges going back and forth, and there's a real kind of sharp humour being displayed, especially between, I was going to say, Anna Cold Marshall's character and the visiting boyfriend, but actually it's between her character and everybody. She is there to kind of be quite spiky. And, you know, that you couldn't ask for somebody better to do that kind of part. But I think that is the real kind of success of it, is in the comic moments and in the comic dialogue. It's very impressively done. I think generally it comes across as a very, very impressive debut. I think you do wonder whether things would have been commissioned if it wasn't by somebody with connections. And, you know, on the basis of this, I would have said, I would have hoped that they would have commissioned it if it had come from a complete unknown, because it certainly is good enough to be being put on a stage. It's obviously got a slightly more high-profile creative team than it might have had if it had just been picked out of a bin of submissions. But there is it's not just the cast and creatives, you know, salvaging it. There is obviously a lot of good quality in the script itself. So it's definitely, I think it's worth seeing. I think it's not particularly a unique piece, but it's some of what it covers has been covered many times before, but it's got its own sort of identity to it, and it's very well performed. And yes, Amanda Root is spectacular in it. She's an actress I've always been very fond of, because she was the first Lady Macbeth I ever saw, so I like to see her back on the stage and see what she's up to. Yeah, it's maybe not the showiest part in the play, but she does show a lot of quite a powerful performance in there. There's a lovely set design as well, which takes over the whole of the space, really kind of drops the audience in traverse into the middle of this house. It's very well done. It's a good kind of occasionally powerful evening's theatre, but there are moments that don't work, certainly.
I'm now going to talk about Farragut North at the Southwark Playhouse. This is a play by Beau Willimon, and it was turned into a film called The Ides of March, which came out in 2011, starring George Clooney and
Ryan Gosling. This production, directed by Guy Unsworth, the major person they're bigging up on this is Max Irons, who has the misfortune, in some ways, of being the son of Sinead Cusack and Jeremy Irons, which is quite a burden for a young actor, I think, that kind of expectation. So, Rev Stan, how does this compare to the film? Tell us more about it and what you thought about Max Irons, amongst others.
Well, the story is that it's set in America around the Democrat caucuses, which is where they fight it out to become the sort of presidential candidate. And the two central characters, Stephen, played by Max Irons, is the sort of head PR. He started working on political campaigns sort of a very young age. They talk about him starting working when he was 15, and he's worked his way up, and I think he's 26 now, and they kind of talk about him being an old hand. And the other central character is a guy called Paul, who's the communications manager, campaign manager for the candidate that they're trying to get into, trying to make the presidential candidate for the Democrats. So this is all about political manipulation. It's all about trying to rubbish your rivals. It's about twisting stories. It's about manipulating the press, trying to get stories in the press. So as a political drama, it's got everything you want from a political drama. Everybody's being manipulative. It's sort of who do you trust, who's manipulating who, and who's going to come out on top. Now, the film Ides of March is quite different. They've spun out some of the characters. They have extra characters in there, like they're in the play. They don't have the actual Democrat candidate, whereas in the film they do. And it's difficult when we've had a film like that that's got such a stellar cast. I mean, you mentioned Ryan Gosling and you mentioned George Clooney, but it also had the likes of Philip Seymour Hoffman and Paul Giamatti in it as well. Absolutely fantastic cast. And when you've got that as a backdrop, you kind of think, well, how's this going to work? Now, I mean, I really like the film. I really like the play as well for different reasons. I think this is more pared down. It's got fewer characters in it. It's more focused. I think it's darker than the film. I think it doesn't go the way you quite imagine it to go, or it certainly didn't go the way the film went, and which is kind of what I was expecting having seen the film first. I thought Max Irons did a great job. The character of Stephen has to be very, very charismatic. He has to win over the press. He has to be very sort of manipulative, but in a very, very charming way. And I thought he carried that off really, really well. I thought, first, because I have actually seen this twice, I didn't warm to Sean Williamson's Paul to start with. I thought his performance was a little bit affected, but that was the very first performance. And when I saw it again, which was after press night, he'd relaxed into the role a bit more. I thought the two actresses, there's an intern who Stephen has a relationship with. I thought she was very good. Aisha Khala plays Molly, the intern. I thought she did a great job. And the Rachel Tucker played the manipulative and very sassy journalist Ida. And I thought they both did very, very good jobs. I thought they were very, most immediately sort of relaxed into their roles and were very, very believable. And I just thought it was a very good, tense political drama. I was sort of like sitting there on the edge of my seat all the way through, wondering who was manipulating who, because everybody has their part to play and nobody particularly comes out of it very well. All the characters have flaws. I mean, some are more victim or bigger victims than others, but they all play their own part in trying to manipulate events for their own ends. And I thought it was a great piece of political drama, and very simply staged at the Southwark Playhouse with just bare minimum of furniture. And I really enjoyed it. I must say, I saw it twice and I enjoyed it very much both times.
I was quite impressed by the performances and the acting of it. I wasn't entirely happy with the play. I did kind of think there's got to be a good way that he gets out of this, and in the end, I don't think there was. I don't think it ended entirely satisfactory. It was logical, but it wasn't. You sort of get to know Stephen, and you kind of quite like him and want to know what's going on. I mean, he's not without very deep flaws, but he's certainly interesting to watch, and I think Max Irons does him very well. In fact, I had a quick look at the film and found it a lot more charismatic than Ryan Gosling. I was interested in the story and the way it was done. I was a little bit disappointed in the end by the whole thing. You wanted him to be able to spin his way out of the situation he gets himself in, and I thought that he doesn't. He just takes some petty revenge, and it doesn't really get you anywhere. And I found that unsatisfying. So, what did you think about Farragut North, Nick?
The ending is, well, it's certainly not. I don't know that it's unsatisfying, because I think it's kind of the point, isn't it? It's not. I didn't think it was surprising particularly, because I think to me it was a story about the corruption of the people who maybe not are the idealists behind the scenes of politics, but who are most responsible for the language of the idealism. These are the people who are selling the idealism and very possibly started out from that place. So I think it kind of was the point that he was just going to become this petty, corrupted, kind of vindictive, power-seeking person. And I found this an interesting play. I think it's a strange sort of some of these levels of American politics where, I mean, you're looking at, I mean, when it comes down to it, you're looking at the campaign to get someone to become the candidate. It's on a scale that kind of British politics doesn't really work at. So, you know, but it's still this huge deal. So it could only really be set in American politics at that level. You'd have to be looking at an actual election to get even close to it in British politics. But this is, I mean, we're, you know, this epic kind of thing that's going on is in the very early stages of trying to become the candidate for the next presidential election a couple of years in advance. So it's kind of fascinating how that scale works. And you kind of have to take a step back and see what story you're seeing, that it is this very early stage. I think something I hadn't seen before, which I found interesting about this, is the way it focuses entirely on people whose careers in politics aren't forever, are not the politics itself. It is just people who are going to go there, try and get someone to win an election, and win or lose, that's the end of their story with that candidate. The next in their life is the next election. This is a side of politics that is not connected to actually governing anything. It's entirely based around the elections. It's entirely based around the race. As soon as this campaign ends, there'll be a bigger or smaller, there'll be a governor's election somewhere they'll go on to and work on, you know, and whether that wins or whether that person wins or loses, it'll be something else again. So it's a strange kind of life they're kind of painting of people. I think that there's some very good performances in there. It sounds like the actors are having to deal with a fair bit of audience participation that wasn't intended. The performance I was at was pretty light because Sean Williamson's character drops a piece of paper at one point and one of the audience decided to hand it to him. But I think that's nothing as compared to apparently a few days ago a woman in the front row started stroking Max Irons' leg with her foot in the middle of a scene. I mean, he does get very up close to the audience, but I don't think he expected that to be the result. But they're a very strong cast. It's a very claustrophobic kind of world that they've created in there, and I think it's a very tense, well-worked-out political thriller.
We're now going to talk about Storm in a Flower Vase at the Arts Theatre in the West End. This is a new play by Anthony Burge about the floral designer and cookery writer Constance Spry. I was recommended when I first moved away on my own to get myself a copy of the Constance Spry cookery book. So it is a very comprehensive volume and rather large. So she's been a name I've always known about. So it looks a rather interesting play. She was a pioneering writer in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. She is the person who created the rather interesting dish, coronation chicken, which some people nowadays look down on, I think. But she was obviously a rather interesting character, and this play obviously seeks to tell us more about her. So, Phil, what did you think about it, and tell me more?
Well, I think the thing that I found most interesting is that I really didn't know much about Constance Spry. Like you, I knew her name, and I knew that she was famous for flower arranging. I think I only heard about the Coronation Chicken when I read the blurb for the play. I didn't know that she was the person behind it, and I'm not going to thank her for it, so I'm not keen on it, but anyway. And I think in a way, if you're intending to see this play, we ought to put a massive spoiler alert, because the only way I can talk about it is to say what actually was interesting about her life, of which I knew nothing. And it's quite a racy life for its day. So I'd switch off now if you're intending to see it. Otherwise, listen on. I mean, she was in a sort of a marriage of sorts, without giving too much away, to a rather dull sort of husband, or at least he's quite dull the way he's played here. Although the husband actually is having an affair with the woman who pretty much was running a lot of Constance Spry's business. She worked in the shop with her, and she was very much the mainstay and a good friend of Constance Spry. And it sort of seemed that they had a kind of an open marriage. She was quite aware of the affair. And she then goes on and meets an artist called Gluck, she's obviously a name because she has her own Wikipedia entry. And Gluck is actually a woman. And the moment she comes on, you can kind of see where the play's heading, because she's sort of dressed in a man's suit, and she's very much sort of the cliched lesbian of the day. And they have an affair, and I think they fall in love with each other. It's quite clear, at least from the way the play is here. So, and then there's the relationship between Gluck and Constance Spry, and Constance Spry and her husband, and then Gluck also meets somebody else. So that has sort of spoiled it. But I didn't know all that, and actually that's what makes the play interesting, not knowing about Constance Spry. As a play itself, it's sort of one of those plays that has slight problems. It has to sort of get information about who she was, who she is in the play, across to you, and I found some of that quite shoehorned in. I mean, there's rather, it felt awkward to me, where Constance Spry describes the Easter Rising, and it's sort of those kind of things where I feel it lets it down. It's quite a sort of plodding play in many ways. I think the performances sort of range from underpowered to overpowering. Although I have to say, one performance in it, which is quite entertaining, which is the quite overpowering one, is from Carol Royal, because obviously the character she's playing, which here is Cyril Maugham, the wife of W. Somerset Maugham, is a sort of society woman who's really, really full on. And that's quite a fun performance. And she employs Spry to do flowers for her home, and I don't know enough about interior design, but she sort of discovers, or at least that's how I felt here, sort of the white room, where everything is white with a white floral display from Constance Spry in the room. And all those elements I found interesting. I think also, for what's, because it's at the Arts Theatre, which is quite a small theatre and it has probably quite a limited budget, visually I was quite impressed. There's quite a simple set from Morgan Large, but it really does work for the different locations of the flower shop, the interiors. It's quite elegant. There's quite good costuming, and you do get an awful lot of blooms on stage. I mean, they're obviously fake, at least most of them I think are fake. From halfway back in the stalls, they look completely convincing, and you do get a lot of flower amount ranging for your money, so I think all that is quite interesting. It didn't really work for me wholly as a play. It's not quite dramatic enough, but the story is quite interesting.
It looks to have a fairly interesting cast. We've got Penny Downey playing Constance Spry, as well as Carol George. You've got Sheila Ruskin, Sally George, and Christopher Ravenscroft, who's presumably playing the husband. What were they like?
I don't want to sort of argue. One of the performances I really struggled with, I thought, I don't want to name names, but if you go to the theatre a lot, you do will know a lot of these names. It's quite an impressive ensemble they've got together. I sort of varied a bit with Penny Downey's performance as Spry. I think she injects something into it that is kind of otherwise lacking in the play. I found her quite likeable. The friend I went with found her a bit overpowering, and I know other people have as well. But I think Constance Spry probably had an incredible amount of energy, and I think that's what she's sort of doing here. And I think it sort of does add something to the evening. You do get it tops and tail, and there's little bits with where Spry gives lectures, because she was a teacher and she gives lectures to sort of women's institutes and things like that about flower arranging. And you do see slides of her actual work behind it, which kind of brings it slightly to a standstill, but it's at the same time it was quite interesting seeing the real flower arrangements, which to us now don't look that amazing, but I'm sure in their day they were quite something.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast page in Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.